I'm Afshin Rattansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Tomorrow, 48 years since the death of Mao, credited with building the foundations of what is now the most economically powerful country on earth by PPP, New York hosts the 80th UN General Assembly. That despite China, Russia, India, and the New World Order seeking urgent reform of the whole organization, emphasized by the US's refusal of visas for Palestinian officials amidst the Holocaust. This, as a Quinnipiac poll showed, half of American voters now say Israel is committing genocide, echoing the conclusion of the International Association of Genocide Scholars. Yet Trump doubles down behind Netanyahu, now seeking, with the US slave states of Western Europe, a war on perhaps nuclear Iran. Britain, which has been running spy flights to better target the genocide, has, along with France and Germany, sought to starve Iran's people with sanctions after Iran's reward for IAEA compliance was mass death and betrayal. As for the nuclear flashpoint of Ukraine, Britain and the EU are threatening to send in troops to kill Russians. Joining me again from Falls Church, Virginia, is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a 30-year U.S. Army veteran and former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. He's proposing moving the UN from New York to Shanghai. Colonel Wilkerson, thank you so much for coming back on. Before we get on to the UN General Assembly and anything else, you joined the Army in 1966. What were you doing with a friend of the show, Randy Credico, the great activist and comedian and the heroic whistleblower, Commander Chief Master Sergeant Dennis Fritz, trying to help a billboard protesting something in Washington? I understand a similar billboard. The person was detained on the 21st of August. I know you have a First Amendment there. Just tell me what you were doing.
The real problem with us doing it in Washington, D.C., we found out at the moment we were about to embark, and that is that you can't display children. An ordinance, apparently, and we were warned about it right there on the spot. What we were displaying, of course, were some of the saddest, most horrifying scenes from Gaza, and also some of the people responsible for it, such as Bibi Netanyahu. And we were displaying it in rather large terms, videos on three sides of the truck, two left and right side and in the rear, and using a truck that Randy Credico, whom many people probably know, remember from his days as a comic, for example, not a comic like Zelensky, I'm glad to say, but he had been doing it on Times Square in front of the Lincoln Center in Williamsburg and other places in New York. And had some success, but was on one or two occasions accosted by what we thought were probably Mossad hired or even Mossad thugs. But no one ever got really rough with him. He was scared a couple of times. So we were very, very, very concerned about what was going to happen to him in Washington, given that there were state militias in Washington. There was the FBI. There was the D.C. police. There was ICE. My taxi driver, for example, bringing me into Washington, an Afghan, but a citizen of the United States, was checking his papers to make sure. And two taxi drivers from the same company refused to take me into D.C. They're very concerned. These taxi drivers are mostly Pakistani, they're Ugandan, they're Ethiopian, and this man was an Afghan. So the situation was a bit dicey, but it turned out fairly well. Randy said he never had any problem with law enforcement and only on one occasion had a brush with them, and that was a very pleasant brush because they were positive and helped him.
I mean, infamously, demonstrations against U.S. foreign policy, I suppose the most famous one, Kent State, when U.S. troops do kill demonstrators. But this is different, isn't it? Because I quoted that Quinnipiac poll. Most Americans view it as genocide. The U.S. foreign policy here is...
Yeah, I think that's true. I think when you see Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, taking the stance she is now taking in the House of Representatives, you understand there's a shift taking place. It might even be a dramatic shift, slowly but surely, and very, very late, considering all the casualties and the bloodshed in Gaza and the West Bank, Jerusalem, Syria, Lebanon. need I go on, Netanyahu seems intent on the original conception of a greater Israel, which means even parts of Eastern Africa. This man won't stop until he's got someone in front of him with a gun telling him to stop. And right now, there doesn't seem to be anyone who wants to do that.
Yeah, and Trump's response, usually he wants popularity, for the 80th UN General Assembly tomorrow, Trump is banning the Palestinian officials. I mean, Palestinian officials have come under a lot of criticism from their own population, it should be added, and is banning children from getting medical help, their visas, and pouring weaponry to Netanyahu. Why is he doing it?
You got the answer. I'll take it. I won't necessarily like it, but I'll take it because I don't have an answer. I thought I did. I thought I had an answer that concerned the volatility, the mercurial nature, the almost left-right of Donald Trump. But I don't even think it's that anymore. I don't think he's actually getting any advice that's worth anything from Rubio, from Hegseth, from anyone in his cabinet or sub-cabinet. You know, often the sub-cabinet people who are often people who've been around, not necessarily political appointees, give you better advice than the actual cabinet head. And most presidents learn that over time, and certainly most national security advisors do. But I don't think Trump is getting advice worth anything.
Well, hang on, Colonel, because he is getting advice from someone you probably know when you were at the U.S. State Department. Tony Blair, your good friend. When you were Colin Powell's...
Oh, yes, good old Tony Blair.
What did you make? Like what was your first reaction when you heard that Tony... Because Trump says he's against the Iraq war. He campaigned for presidential elections. Proof of his foreign policy power was he knew the Iraq war, which killed, wounded, or displaced tens of millions of people, was the wrong thing. What was your reaction to hearing he was there? And what on earth was Tony Blair, a war criminal, doing in the White House?
Yeah, I don't have any reactions to Donald Trump anymore except befuddlement and mystery. He's all over the map. And you're absolutely right about Tony Blair. If there are two people on the face of the earth from the Bush administration that I abominate most is Tony Blair and George Tenet, the director of the CIA. They were in league with the things they did. Blair's the famous person who said, in 45 minutes, missiles could land in London. And now look at him. He's gone the track of the, I don't know if he's a billionaire yet, but he's probably close. And he's made a lot of this money out of what others like him have made their money out of, acting as if he were a peacemaker or some kind of great negotiator, when in effect, he's nothing much better than Trump. He's just a little smoother.
His wife, bizarrely, has been on this show, I should add. Of course, Trump loves the UAE, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's called it out as genocide. I understand the UAE is warning Israel annexation in the occupied West Bank would constitute a red line that could severely undermine the Abraham Accords. Things are moving slightly faster than they have done over the course of this genocide. What happens now as regards Netanyahu's designs on Iran amidst all of this? Could we see, I mean, it may have started while I'm talking to you, Trump will not hold Netanyahu back should he wish to attack Iran?
Well, first, your point about the Arab countries, some of them are coming around kind of late, but one of the reasons they're coming around is, like Saudi Arabia, for example, they had a record year executing people, over 200 people. A lot of those people, if you examine what we do know about them, were people who were protesting what's happening in Gaza. Even journalists like Khashoggi, not Khashoggi, of course, but journalists doing similar things.
We often get strange reporting about Saudi Arabia in the NATO nation press often that seeks to attack Saudi Arabian human rights just when Saudi Arabia is coming on side for human rights historically.
Right. Well, I think there is some pressure in the street, finally. And these executions, at least some of them, prove that. There are people who are speaking out. So there's got to be some pressure on these Arab capitals to do something other than just pontificate or say that it should be carried out, finished, and then the Abraham Accords implemented, which seems to be their real concern. I don't think they're going to be too happy about a war with Iran, though. And I think there's at least a 60-40 chance, if not greater, that war is coming about before Christmas, maybe even before Thanksgiving. And they're not going to be happy about that because I think Iran is going to share some of the wealth, if you will, with them when it strikes back.
Well, they're close ties. Close ties between the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Iran against the policy think tank ideas in where you are in Washington, in fact.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think right now there's a lot of conflicted talk in all the capitals that matter, but particularly in Riyadh and particularly in the Emirates, in Bahrain even, and in Qatar. I think they're probably as much conflicted inside their governments and political apparatus as anybody else.
But then what happens if there's an attack on Bushehr? I'm talking to you 100 miles away from the Bushehr reactor.
That's interesting. Maybe they'll put one on your head.
I mean, no, but you, those are quite high percentages if Israel attacks Iran, and the huge impact, of course, it would have on global trade, but of course on this region. Explore what pressures against Israel there are to stop that, to prevent that from happening.
Well, there's massive pressure against them from other capitals in the world who don't want it to happen, but that pressure doesn't make any difference to Netanyahu, and he's the government right now. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu is not just the face of Israel, he is Israel right now. And wherever Bibi Netanyahu wants to go, he's going to go, and the United States is going to follow, however reluctantly, and I think we will follow reluctantly, with war. And that's the only way that Netanyahu is going to get out of it, if he does. But what he's going to do in the process is drag the United States into a war that it can't win either. So thank you very much. We're in World War III. Tack that on to what's happening in the Arctic, what's happening in the Balkans, or the Baltic Sea, what's happening in Kaliningrad, perhaps, what's happening in Ukraine and around Ukraine, what's happening in other places between Ukraine and the Caucasus and below the Caucasus. You got the world war already going. You've got several theaters already going. And all it needs to do is merge, and it will eventually, and we're going to have a damn fine war. Thank you very much.
Well, I was speaking on Saturday's show to important Russian analyst about perhaps the need for preemption rather than parades in Beijing and shows of power and unity. Do you think it's a time that these countries start to preemptively act ahead of what you're saying is World War III that's already begun?
Well, I've said, and will say again and again and again until it fails completely, that we should have a UN General Assembly vote. We should have Mohamed Abbas send a letter, and the letter's already in the works, to the UN General Assembly. Push the UN Security Council and the Secretary General aside, other than the Secretary General has to preside over this, but he has to preside over it. And then we get a two-thirds vote in the UNGA, and then we call for countries to contribute to a United for Peace. It's more like a Chapter 7 operation. That means they can have ROE that are robust, that they can shoot to kill if necessary. They're establishing peace, not enforcing a peace, and ask China to lead the way. It would not only embarrass the hell out of the American empire, and believe me, we would fight it tooth and nail trying to keep it from happening. But under international law, it could happen that way, and we have no table to stand on.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, I'll stop you there. More from the former chief of staff of the U.S. State Department after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former chief of staff at the U.S. State Department, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Colonel, you were talking about ways the U.N. General Assembly can act to try and create peace in this world. In the context of that, I think I have to ask, can Netanyahu actually respond unilaterally with the Israeli nuclear weapons to any kind of preemptive peacekeeping attempt? It's not like Britain's fake nuclear deterrent that needs a key from the United States. Can Israel just launch nuclear weapons?
I think the better question there is, and I go back to Golda Meir in the 73 war when she told a BBC reporter that, of course, if it were existential, she would authorize the use of a nuclear weapon. There's your answer. You could say that was a political response because she wanted the BBC to put that message out so everyone could hear it, including the Russians. But I think it's a serious matter with Bibi Netanyahu, and I think the circumstance you're describing that would prompt that I would describe to prompt that, would be existential situation created by a resumption of the war with Iran, which it will clearly be. Iran is going to shellack Israel. It's going to destroy Israel. What does Bibi Netanyahu do? He's looking at state destruction, and he's looking at his own political and personal destruction. That worries me. That truly worries me because I don't think there are too many real checks on his ability to use one of the 200 or so nuclear weapons that we think they have.
But for U.S. national security, is there no fail-safe? I mean, there are obviously going to be U.S. agents in Israel monitoring things. This would obviously destroy world trade. It would create a worldwide depression, let alone the radiation impact in this region. Can the United States not stop that? I mean, you were at the State Department. You should know things like this.
First of all, I'd have to say we aren't prone to stop anything Israel's going to do. This might be the first thing that we would be maybe prone to do, but I don't think we could do it. I simply don't think we could do it. Short of putting military forces on the ground and taking Dimona away from them and any other assets they may have, I would guess that they probably have distributed some of those airdropped weapons and some of the missiles that go on their submarines. We needn't forget about those, which are on patrol most of the time. I wouldn't doubt that they have spread these out a little bit to preclude just what you're suggesting.
Sorry to interrupt that. You mean Israel have nuclear weapon launchable from submarines?
We don't know that. I don't know that. But I have to conclude that with their ingenuity, and they are some of the smartest people on the face
of
the
earth. Well, they stole the program. They got the program in South Africa, didn't they?
Well, it doesn't take that much, as we're proving, to do something like that with a. You wouldn't even have to. You could jury rig it, as it were. These are pretty decent submarines. They're pretty quiet submarines, and I'm sure there's always one in the Eastern Mediterranean. And then the other side of this, I think the Iranians would be stupid, and I don't think the Iranians are stupid. Not to change their minds for very practical reasons, existential practical reasons, and have their own bomb. I think they could do it in a very short time, and then Israel is confronted with they've got one too, we've got one, and we're much smaller than they are. A couple of bombs on Israel, and Israel is toast. So we're looking at an extremely dangerous situation right now. Were I the Ayatollah, were I the leadership clique in Iran, the group, the IRGC, the regular military, the Guardian Council, if I were that group, I wouldn't hesitate. I wouldn't hesitate. I would have made a decision regardless of the edict, the anathema declaration that nuclear weapons are to Muslims and to Islam, and particularly to the Ayatollah. I think they believe that. But I would have made the decision to go ahead and build a nuclear weapon and do it as fast as I could, and I think they could do it fairly rapidly.
Well, as if to show that Ayatollah Khamenei is not indeed supreme leader, the parliament in Iran, of course, voted to finally eject the NPT. tea. And apparently those IAEA inspectors before the snapback sanctions were instituted by European nations was because Russia wanted IAEA people in for the Bushehr reactor. So some people think Iran, I mean, it could already have nuclear weapons. And certainly, could North Korea play a role here in exerting a deterrent on Israel?
I don't think North Korea would play that role. I think you're looking at another nuclear power that might play that role if it were called upon to do so, but I don't think they're going to, and that would be Russia, of course. I think probably some of the deliberations at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization recent summit must have been on that very thing. What is the possibility with regard to deterrence and with regard to threatening and other things you might do with nuclear weapons? Putin has been very explicit about it at times, and very smart and very wise about the way he uses that, but doesn't go quite far enough. I think we're looking at a realignment of, as I've said many times, we're looking at a complete realignment of power in the world. And this summit was a manifestation of that. Not only was it China and Russia, but it was Modi and India too. We're talking about 2+ billion people. We're talking about a third of the freaking world is now aligned forcibly and powerfully against the American empire and against its vassals in Western Europe.
Well, there may be signs of optimism there for the rest of this show. People might have been getting depressed, but could it be that the forces of capital here are more powerful than Miriam Adelson, Netanyahu, Smotrich, and the rest of them, because they don't want to lose their oligarchic power? Do you think structurally there is something not only from the SCO, but from the leaders of capital in Western, so-called Western countries as well, in NATO countries, that can unite together against this threat, given the threat concerns us all?
That would be a unique thing in history. Most of the time, what the oligarchs of old, and there have been many of them, do is they count their coup as the war is breaking out. They stay on both sides. Some of them will stay on one side exclusive and then jump ship at the last minute, and then shift as the obvious results begin to become very, very obvious. And what you have, go back to Napoleon and how the money moved after Wellington defeated him at Waterloo. Go back to any major conflict, particularly involving imperial powers, and you'll see that these people always keep their powder dry. And they're ready to jump ship at a minute and go to the new empire or the new constellation of power. That'll happen here, too. Banks all across the world are working for all of these different groups and all of these different interests. So it's, you watch the money, follow the money is the old adage, of course. But I don't think for a moment that these people wouldn't desert the current system in the world if they saw another system that would benefit them even more so, aborting. And that's what's happening right now. That is precisely what's happening right now all across the globe. And on top of all of that, you have two challenges that are existential for that globe, not just for individual countries, but for the globe. And I'm talking, of course, of the climate crisis, which we're all so far behind right now that by 2050, we might be having people dying all across the globe from excessive heat, especially old people and especially in the South.
That's a whole other issue. We're running out of time, Colonel, but then how important is it, if it the war hasn't begun already, for Iran to preemptively attack Israel, as it is allowed to do under the UN Charter because of recent events? And is Iran making a grave mistake by not attacking Israel first?
That's a good point, and from a military perspective, I would say it's an excellent point. But from the perspective of knowing the Persians as well as I think I do, especially the ones I've had really close relations with, that would be anathema to them. They are not the kind of people, and I know that everyone in America thinks they're the lowest form of life, or at least a lot of Americans, but they are not the kind of people to do what the Israelis did, assassinate people in their beds. You know, the Israelis try all the time from Argentina to wherever they can pull off a false flag to make it look like the Persians are that kind of people. They aren't. They aren't the kind of people who assassinate world leaders in their beds. They simply aren't. It would be very, very out of character for them as a state and as a people to do something like that. But they will bring holy fire to bear on Israel much more so than they did during the famous 12-day war, which was a disaster for Israel too. They just covered it up and propagandized it. That will be the end of the state of Israel.
And actually, I've got one more question about the SCO, because it was such a momentous week. Some people say a change in human history last week. I know you're impressed by pipelines. All strategic thinkers are. And the crisscrossing of energy pipelines and reserves. But even if you have the north-south corridor that goes from India through Iran up to Russia, these new Siberian lines, we know after Nord Stream, NATO powers, the CIA, can destroy them. Again, are we down to, without any kind of preemption by these burgeoning BRICS SCO powers, it doesn't take that much to destroy the pipelines for all their technological complexity.
That's true, and I've told this story a number of times, but Powell and I were in New York one time, and we were in the operations center of several very big oil conglomerates, not just U.S., but international. And we were briefed on the pipelines pumping, the pipelines under construction, the pipelines contemplated in the world at that time. Of course, it's much wider array now than it was then. But one of the remarks that was made at the time by one of the briefers, who was quite astute, really stuck with me. He said, "You're looking at the future of warfare." He was right. But what we're looking at increasingly is the other side being the predominant force in this war. So who's going to suffer the most if they get angry and respond? And they will.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, thank you.
Gurley, thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide in Gaza. It's 61 years since Malcolm X went to Gaza to show solidarity against Zionism. We'll be back on Saturday to ask Professor Kehinde Andrews, infamous for being on Netflix's Harry and Meghan, why Malcolm X is by any means necessary, still speaks to our world. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored, your country, head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.